I'm Sim Steele from Chris Light. I first arrived in Yangon in 1994 to set up our first overseas branch. And like many foreigners, we do not really have much chance to actually listen to good Dharma talks, as most of the talks were actually conducted in English, in local language, and in the monastery. And we are very fortunate to have the very blessed with my family to visit Sayadaw, popularly known as the Oxford Sayadaw. And we visited him in Oxford in October this year. And I'm so glad that Sayadaw has accepted the invitation to give a speech to foreigners mainly. And most of you here are foreigners. And hopefully you will find meaningful purpose through this session. Today is a wonderful day. Outside is actually a Christmas having a Buddhist Dharma talk in a German cultural center. Thanks, France.
Any language, I don't think we have this word many decades ago, but today it's a common currency. It's a common currency in every country, in East and West, between two genders, between rich and poor. So when you talk about stress, everybody understands. Just a few moments ago, I had maybe 10 or so young, they're my graduates, they just graduated from Singapore in the management, business management. I said, have you ever meditated? I'm sure this question is strange to you, because you think that's for your grandma and grandpa to do, not you. But as a Buddhist mind, I haven't got any words to say, actually. Please, can you ever meditate? Not often. Because as important as this management is, just because if you don't manage yourself on daily basis, there will be slow recovery from your stress. So in order to have quick recovery, it's important that we learn this method. It's what we learn in some form of stress management. And today I'm going to offer you one that's based on Buddhist meditation. It's available here in every corner of Myanmar. We have about 1,000 meditation centers in the country following different forms of meditation. After a while, I'm going to talk to you today. It's an easy form, and it has been is quoted and again you quote it. So this is Harvard Business Review, so the mindfulness. So this is the I'm going to I was talking to school children about stress management. From 13 to 16 years old, 7 to 20. And the way I asked them was, okay, if you hold one brick, if you take one brick from one corner of the house to the
other, just one brick, that's not very difficult. And it's not too heavy. But if you have to carry that, okay, from this corner to the other corner, and then and again and again, now it becomes burdensome. And then, what about you have two pieces of bricks in your hand? Now you can feel the burden straight away. People have two or three bricks in the form of stress in their mind. Say, if you get up in the morning, not having enough sleep because last night you were kind of playing with your iPhone, your iPad, your Facebook, eating away your sleeping time, then physically, you're not quite up to it, but you have to go to work. You have no choice. In that, there's stress on both mind and the body because of lack of sleep. Then, in your school, there's a lot of competition. I am aware of the announcement from Singaporean Education Ministry on competition in October. You know, how they are going to take that approach. So, if the school is very competitive, and you're always thinking about how you're going to perceive your grade and where you are in the class, whether you're good enough, and how to get recognized for your work. You know, it's just to fit into the school. There's another stress. So I'm talking about two types of stress, and you carry two bricks. From home to school, you carry two bricks without knowing. From school and home, you bring those stress back. So again, two bricks with you from the school back to home. For adults in the working life, if we don't know how to process our emotion properly, then remain stressed. Unresolved. And those just unresolved from yesterday, it can be topped up easily. The mind is very good at topping up stress. Especially when we go into fight and flight mode. So, I ask the children
to draw as many bricks as they can imagine, and name them as one type of, stress on each brick. Many of them came out with lots of bricks, and then they couldn't carry it. They were drawing for me. (Clears throat) This is Siddhartha's Brain, a book written by a journalist from England. You can see he got inspiration from this one, Buddha's Brain. Okay, Buddha's Brain. This is from Berkeley, from University of California, Berkeley. Someone who has been meditating for decades and is examining meditation from neurological and clinical psychological viewpoint. This is Dr. Rick Hansen. You can listen to him on YouTube also. The whole book is on YouTube, online. Not sure if this book is online, the Siddhartha's Brain. Now, if you have, or if you keep entertaining stress without processing it, the region of your brain that is more active is called amygdala. That's the old brain. That area of the brain is associated, as you all know, with fight and flight mode, with emergency mode. If you get stuck in a traffic jam in Yangon in the morning, if you start looking at the people in front of you and the lane next to you as hindering your journey to work, now you have too much stress. You're looking at them in a very negative way. Because you have another choice where you can process that information, that experience, in a different way, in a more positive way. You can actually say, those people are also getting stuck, just like me. If you do that, you are operating from a different region of the brain, which is hippocampus area. Now, these experiences, daily experiences, they shape our brain. This is not my research. I'm not part of this, although I'm a founding trustee of the Oxford Mindfulness Center at Oxford University. But I'm not involved in this kind of research. And Oxford only works on depression, especially relapses. And neurology and this kind of thing is associated with Wisconsin University, with Berkeley, and you know, the like at New York University and that. Of course, now some colleges of London University, they also take on this. For example, King's College has a department like psychiatry, psychology, and neurology and meditation, everything combined together. Something that you wouldn't imagine maybe 2 decades ago. Now today is happening. I have been going to Spain since 2003, and for the last 3 years, I also gave a regular talk at Madrid University. Even Madrid University has a research on mindfulness, neurology, and heart. That's cardiology. To see, because these work, they all talk about brain, not the heart. And how is your heart responding to your stress? Not many of them talk about this, because they think the brain is the CEO of the body. And in the brain, the new brain, the prefrontal cortex, is considered to be the CEO of. So everybody is trying to improve this using these contemplative techniques. Ambassador, please come here. Union Minister for Education. Yeah, please come here. Dr. Miu Dingji and our ambassador is. So, as you can see, the so-called the new brain, which is the prefrontal cortex, is prominent only in human being. Meaning only human beings are able to manipulate this or to develop this. If a deer feels danger for its life, it will use all its energy and run away. At that moment, the stress is at its maximum level. At that moment, the deer will shut off. Okay, it might step on its own baby if it's not, okay, if it's into that mode. And the buffalo will actually push each other, or step on each other to death. And the bison in the Yellowstone in America, okay, when they are under a lot of stress because of the wolves, a pack of wolves harassing them, then once the stress got into them and they start operating from the amygdala, now they care about no one but their own escape. So the bison, we push each other and we step over each other. Before that, you can see that behavior. Before they get into that region of the brain, they actually fend off for each other. You can translate this action, this reaction on a family, on a community, on a country, on a region, or maybe internationally. I believe it's possible that the whole family is under a lot of stress and it's operating from the amygdala region. That's the old brain. I also believe, you know, when I go to different cities in Central and Eastern Europe, you can see in some city is a lot of graffiti. Okay, you can see stress and depression is all around. Some part of maybe London, you know, where the development is less than the other parts. You can see that as well. So, in neurological term, our experience is everyday experience. They shape our brain. So I was giving you the example of traffic jam in the morning. If we have positive thinking and we have this EQ awareness, this emotional quotient, we would be able to process the experience of traffic jam in a way that wouldn't be too taxing for us. So we would be arriving at work not so much feeling drained. Some people, they arrive at work so drained because they couldn't handle the stress associated with the journey. Again, at work, if you do not process your stress properly, maybe this is going to affect your work, your relationship with your colleagues, and your energy level. So all these can be affected. Then, if the experiences shape our brain and the brain is operating like that, between the old and the new brain, between the amygdala and the hippocampus region, how we can alter our brain to behave in a way that it can deal with our stress quickly. So this book, Alter Traits, okay, this is by Daniel Goleman and David Richardson, who started meditating in the 70s at a Burmese monastery in Bodh Gaya. The first two retreats under Munindaji, that's the disciple of Mahasi Sayadaw, an Indian meditation teacher, well-known one, Munindaji. He is no more. The next 7-10 days retreat, they practice under S.N. Goenkaji and in the same place. So these two authors back then, PhD student at Harvard University, they were meditating and they became so convinced that meditation can help anyone. They, whether they are Buddhist or not, whether they are believer or non-believer. Okay? Because meditation is about working with your mind directly. It doesn't even require any belief. I was referred to as a Buddhist chaplain to Oxford University. I was referred to by its biology department, a student from Malaysia. She was so stressed out, confused between academic problem and personal problem, which you do in a very competitive environment, okay, very often. And she came because she was referred to by her professor, and she said, okay, my parents are Buddhist, but I don't believe in Buddhism. What do you think you can do for me? I said, well, no, I don't believe that I can do things for you. What I believe is that you can help yourself. If you believe in the same, if you think that you can help yourself. Then we start talking about recognizing the stress, indicators, and observing them non-judgmentally without judging good or bad, without justifying them on the one hand and without ignoring them on the other. Okay? Because we can have two extremes. One is to justify our stress. Say anger, we can actually justify our anger. I'm getting angry because you're stupid. Something like that. The mother may tell someone. And the children may also say, no, I'm very stressed out, mom, because you behave like this, you're nagging at me all the time, like that. So if you are actually justifying your anger or any form of your stress like that, that means you like keeping them. You like keeping your anger. You like keeping your stress. That's why you're doing self justification and self righteousness to keep your anger. So two extremes. One extreme is self justification or to get carried away. The other is suppression of the stress or running away from it. These are two extremes. The animals, the bison in the Yellowstone or in Canada, because that's where they are, and the buffaloes facing lions on daily basis in African safaris, for them, if they had to run away for their life, they would do so using all their energy, maximum energy. But once they have escaped, if they do, once they have escaped from the tiger, from the lions, within a few minutes, 2, 3, 4 minutes, they can relax and start eating the grass, drinking water. We as a human being, okay, if we come back from work, no, we can't shake this off that easily. We bring the stress from work to home. That would be unjust to the family at home. Okay? But if you take your stress at home to work, that would be unjust to your colleagues at work as well. So, if you want to be a positive contribution to the society, the least you can do is to look after your stress. then the way the brain manages and deals with the stress is that it takes care of its emotion, well, the emotion, not its, but the emotion. By managing our emotion, we are reshaping the brain. This book, it says, science reveals how meditation changes your mind, brain, and body. These are the alpha, the waves of the brain. This book says, this is from their research, if you practice meditation or some form of contemplative practices 2 hours a week, 2 hours a week, this is enough to reshape your brain. If you do it every day, 6 days, that would be about 20 minutes a day. 20 minutes a day. You can have 1 day break without meditation, without thinking about Buddhist monks. According to some of the finding, you know, from people like him, this is from MIT, John Kabat-Zinn, you will know him. He's a pioneer in pioneer of mindfulness in medicine, from Massachusetts Institute of Technology, now retired. He was a keynote speaker last August in Budapest, where I was one of the speakers. According to them, in a high-tech company, where most of the staff, has a PhD, a very competitive environment, they did a research, and about 40 or so of staff volunteered to meditate. It's not an easy thing because it's very competitive and he's also very strict with his practice. So he demanded 2 hours a day from those people. I can't see any of you signing it up. 2 hours. But the CEO was very supportive, so about 40 people signed up. After 2 months, those people, they became at work, they became more, 30% more efficient, and they also have extra time. Because they can process their stress there and then, on the spot. They have altered the traits in their brain. So stress can affect relationship, it can affect your business. That is why in the, I come from the, so I'm resident in the UK, in Oxford, so I talk about the UK. In 2015, the All-Party Mindfulness Committee, they have Mindfulness Committee in Westminster. Mindfulness Committee, they issue a report called Mindful Nation UK. You can see this on the Westminster webpage. They recommend the government introduce this in 4 ministries. Education ministry to teachers and students. To health ministry, to the doctors, nurses and patients. To Justice Ministry, mainly the prisons, and then to the civil service. So, Oxford Mindfulness Center has been given a grant to do this, and it has come up with, for example, one program for school, MISP, Mindfulness in School Project. You can see this online on YouTube. MISP, Mindfulness in Schools Project, where children report that they have less stress and there is less bullying program in the school. And they can take maybe 5-10 minutes break and just breathe in the course of doing their homework. And their coach, a professor of clinical psychology from Oslo University, reports the difference between school, you know, with mindfulness practice and others which don't have. Okay. In terms of performance, in terms of the socializing skill among the children, and the outlook in general, you know, how they differ. So, my area, what I have been working on for some time is emotion management. When I say stress management, I talk about how we can work on our emotion. Many people don't actually pay enough attention to their emotional welfare and well-being. Paying attention to emotion is a sign of weakness in some society. So you don't express them. You have to behave as if you are a stone with stone face. I was running maybe an eight days retreat in Singapore at one point. And one Singaporean young lady asked me, "Siaro, meditation teachers are not supposed to smile. Why you smile so much?" You have to have a stone face. You're not supposed to smile. If you smile, people think you're not looking at life seriously, you're not looking at problems of the world seriously. Okay. So emotion, we only have a positive and negative emotion. And the negative emotion cannot flourish. Positive emotion cannot flourish without conscious attention. And negative emotion, they thrive with the subconscious habit. All our habits are stored with our subconscious mind. In psychology, we know subconscious mind as a child. The conscious mind, conscious attention as the mother. So we have the mother and the child in our hearts. And when I become easily irritated, that is the child in my heart is seeking attention from the mother in me, that is awareness, that is mindfulness. So I need to pay attention to that. If I don't pay attention, frustration will become a habit. And this child in my subconscious mind will grow cold, ignore, unloved, unattended to. In the discourse of mindfulness, we call this contemplation on the activities of the mind, citta nupassana, the activities of the mind. So the first quality of mindfulness that we bring in managing our emotion is called non-judgmental mindfulness. Not to be judgmental about our feeling. If I feel frustrated, not to say, "Wow, I'm talking about stress management, I should be feeling frustrated." This is being judgmental. But if I just observe this is frustration, I experience frustration mindfully, with full awareness, then the subconscious mind is not going to top up this frustration. If I say I shouldn't be feeling frustrated, I'm actually torturing myself for the pain that I have. So it's a kind of, you know, double injury. But if I say I'm frustrated easily because, okay, you don't do this, you don't do that. If I blame other people, then I'm justifying my frustration. I am entertaining it. So without being judgmental, without adding any value to the frustration, to the agitation, to the impatience, what we do, we just recognize them as they are. We acknowledge them. Just as the mother acknowledges her son's calling for attention, her toddler son calling for attention. So we acknowledge this. This is at the heart of any Buddhist meditation practices we have here in Myanmar. We register this. So I usually talk about 3 R, register, release and return. So we register frustration, we register impatience, we register restlessness, we register the physical tiredness, we just register it. Acknowledge it. Of course, it's even better if you can acknowledge this with kindness for yourself. As if the mother is being very compassionate towards her only and one child. If we can do so, then the quality of mindfulness is enhanced. Then the second thing we need to do is to learn how to move our attention. Okay, with awareness to move our attention from frustration back to breathing, maybe back to something, and maybe to a painting, maybe to the greenery outside. Just move your attention. If you don't, you're going to be overwhelmed by the stress. So it's important to move this. I usually call this attention movement control. You control your attention by moving it to a different object. But of course, you have to have one neutral object where you can keep coming to, safe and sound. That neutral one is not emotion, but is a physical object like breathing. So breathing is a neutral object that we choose. A Buddhist breathing and non-Buddhist breathing, there's no difference. A Buddhist monk's breathing and someone who has never meditated, okay, that person's breathing, there is no difference either. We all have to breathe because we have to supply oxygen to our brain, our body, the whole body, the blood, the vein and all that. And we need to release all the toxics, you know, from our body, inside our body. So breathing is actually very neutral in terms of emotion. We focus on that. Before we open to questions and answers, I would like to invite you to do this first for 3 minutes, and then I give another instruction and we do another 3 minutes. Okay. If I say 5 minutes, some people might bargain with me. I know discount is something everybody likes. So, only 3 minutes. I know people won't be able to hug it. So what you can do is relax, okay? You can lean on your chair. You can lean on your chair. Okay? It's okay if you're physically tired. Just acknowledge that. And then come back to breathing. Acknowledge that, come back to breathing. But if your mind is all over the places, just register that as auto mind. This is automatic mind. 3 or 4 times, this is auto mind. It's like this. It's just thinking without any plan. This is auto mind. And then return to breathing. If you feel any cramp, any pain, any numbness in your body, pay attention to that. Don't ignore that. Pay attention to that. This is numbness. This is there is some sensation here. There is some discomfort. After you have acknowledged that, just come back to breathing. Breathing is the center, is your home. 3 minutes. You can count your breathing if you like. 1 to 5 for one in breath, 1 to 5 for an out breath. Breathing in slow and gentle, counting 1 to 5. Don't fight with your thoughts. Don't run away from them either. Just acknowledge them. This is auto thought. This is automatic thoughts. This is thinking. This is thinking. It's already 3 minutes. Okay, I don't know how you feel, but I'm going to ask you to embrace your stress even further. This is to behave like a good mother. When her child is crying, she's not going to abandon ignore the child. And she's not going to be fighting with the child. Instead, she will pay total attention, actively thinking how to help the child, okay, to stop crying. So the mother would embrace the pain of her child. Children, you know, don't develop reasoning ability until a certain age. But when the mother picks them up and hold them, hug them, they get the message of comfort, the message of reassurance, the experience of being embraced. And mostly the children will stop crying because they feel reassured. You're going to be embracing that kind of thing. So either today, in the last week, in the last month, or this year, we are going to be welcoming the new year soon. Some part of the country in Myanmar already starts, okay, welcoming their new year. For example, in Shan State, and then the Karen State coming soon, the Kachin State, that sort of thing. So in the last year, if there is anything, you know, that reaches in your mind too stressful, revisit that incident, visualize that, and try to, as you breathe in and out, there will be emotion coming up in the form of blaming yourself or blaming other people, in the form of dissatisfaction, in the form of, you know, many other positive or negative emotion. Your task is to just embrace them as if that particular emotion is your only and one child. We say one child because we pay attention to only one object at a time. One thing at a time is the mantra in meditation. One thing at a time. So embrace that pain, that emotional pain, and release that. You come back to breathing, or you can move on to another emotion. Sometimes the images will flash back, okay, in your mind. Will come back in your mind. The images associated with stress in the office, at home, in the society, anything. Just embrace them. Embrace them. If you expect them and embrace them like this, if you're getting to know them, you become more and more familiar with them. There is less chance of going into fight and flight mode. The fight and flight mode comes from being caught, okay, by surprise. When we panic because we don't expect it. Benjamin Disraeli, one of the former British prime ministers, okay. You know this quote already. Hope for the best and prepare for the worst. This is his. So you actually prepare for the worst. You embrace your emotion. You expect more stress at work and in other aspects of your life. When you expect them, when they actually come, you don't get surprised and you don't panic. So there is no panicking. There's a panicky reaction. Instead, there will be a measured response to process the stress that we have. So first, try to visualize or revisit your own stress. Embrace that. Second, try to revisit your best friend or your family member, especially the family member that you're on good terms with. Not the one that, I have to say so, Because some family members, they give you a lot of stress. So, we go easy first. First yourself. Second, your loved ones. The third one, your colleagues. Your colleagues, okay. Three people. We only have 3 minutes. I really want you to encourage you to focus on the stress that come from the people you know you have argument with, but we don't have time. For today, let's focus on these three groups. First yourself, your own stress. Sometimes it comes from uncertainty. Sometimes, you know, from unavoidable, you know, circumstances. Whatever the reason, just embrace your stress. Number two, try to relate to the stress of your loved ones. If they are anxious, if they are worried, if they are easily agitated, you know, just recognize those emotions. The third one, your colleagues. If they feel threatened, if they, you know, come under a lot of pressure and then feel irritated easily, lose their control easily, you know, just trying to relate to their emotion, embracing them as if they are your only and one child. We start with breathing in and out, in and out. Another 3 minutes, then we can have Q&A. Slow and gentle breathing. okay, and seeing if maybe we can open the floor for discussion.
Sure.
Thank you.
Before I open to the floor, there was one thing that I forgot to announce just now. Sayado has actually founded the Taoji Buddhist University 2 years ago in 2016. There are more than 20,000 Buddhist literatures in English. And all of you, and including your friends and relatives, are welcome to go there and learn and study. And while we're having the Q&A, I'm sure you have a lot of questions. Sayador needs to go to Thailand tonight, so his flight is at 7 something, so he's got to leave by 5 o'clock sharp. And I understand that there are some guests who would like to pay a special respect to Sayador, so we give a bit of time for that. Probably I will end the Q&A by 4:50, so you have got 40 minutes time. Please go ahead.
I thank you so much for your talks. My question is, when one sits for meditation, sometimes one encounters sleep. So how do you fight with sleep and that sleep so that it can be more fresh? And
you mean to fight with sleep or to manage your sleep?
To fight with sleep so that you don't sleep and you meditate.
Can you repeat again? You have sleepiness problem in meditation?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
And when you begin to meditate, you get a strong dose of sleep. And then you still meditate, but you're half asleep. You're not fully, agile and, you know, meditating.
Thank you. This is a common problem that we have to face. And I myself still have this problem. Especially if I live in a cold environment, in a cold climate like in England. I don't have that problem in tropical Asia. But every morning, okay, in Oxford, I will have this problem. So I'd like to share with you from my experience, not from the book. You have two problems here. You need to separate two problems. One is the sleepiness itself, which is the physical, mainly the physical issue. The other is the attitude towards sleepiness in meditation. I myself, because I pay more attention to emotion, so I tackle the attitude problem first. When I start to nod. To feel sleepy, I will look at my subconscious reaction. I mean, whether I dislike this. Sometimes we don't really want this to entertain this sleepiness in meditation because we think this is a failure. We consider our effort to be a failure. So this is an attitude. Sleepiness is not necessarily a failure. Okay? Sometimes it's purely a physical requirement. Very simple. But if we develop this attitude, we need to tackle this attitude first. Sometimes if we meditate in a group, if I fall asleep, I'm afraid of the negative impression from other people, which is fear, which is insecurity, feeling insecure. One day I was leading a short session like this. I think that was my third or my fourth session for the whole day in different places. So we only meditated for 20 minutes, and I fell asleep for about 5 minutes. And the lady sitting in front of me, When we had a Q&A session, she said she had one comment. And when she got the microphone, she just said one thing. I saw you falling asleep. She just said that. And the next thing she said was, she felt so relieved that I also fell asleep. She came to, well, before that, she felt so lonely. She felt that falling asleep in meditation was unique to her. Whenever she entertained that thought, that her problem was unique to her, she has no connection with other people. So this is an attitude problem that meditation tries to address. Not to personalize, but rather to universalize it. To universalize that this is actually a common problem. And when we look at our body with compassion, this body has its own limit. How long we can sit, there's a limit. The energy we recharge for the day is limited as well. We need to keep recharging this. Our attention span is limited. Everything is limited. That limitation in Pali is called dukkha. We just have to accept it. Okay? And live with that. So, in terms of attitude, we look at our mind reacting to this sleepiness. Dislike, frustration, thinking negatively about ourselves, at the bottom of it is insecure feeling, seeing that this is a failure. So if we address all those, if we fall asleep, it will only be 2-3 minutes, and that will be some of the best recharges, okay, that we have. Because both the mind and the body will be resting at the same time. At the same time. But sometimes the quality sleep doesn't come from the night sleep. It comes from meditation. I'm selling sleep in meditation. So, and if we meditate, and we come across this problem often, we can examine whether it's due to the posture. Sometimes, sitting brings sleepiness. Or whether it's due to the atmosphere, whether we get enough ventilation. And we can also examine whether we have accumulated too much stress. And we need to relax them. We need to release those stress. All those things, they contribute to sleepiness in meditation. Of course, the last thing is the sleepiness that is purely mental, purely psychological. But that one, we have no problem with this in short session, in 30 minutes, in 1 hour session. Usually we don't have problem with this. When we actually go deep into meditation, then we discover the psychologically related problem of sleepiness. The solution to that is different. So basically, I would say sleepiness is an innocent function of the body. Actually, you need this. Some people, they can't sleep and they have to take a pill. So when you fall asleep in meditation, perhaps you should celebrate. Change your attitude. Instead of beating yourself. At the back, yes.
Sierra, Today I speak with my friend about meditation, and he thought meditation is aiming to zero level and is releasing your family living, something like that. Because what they understand is Buddha said this is dukkha, this is anatta, this is like that. So he misunderstand in another way and think we are going to zero level, taking nothing, giving everything, and he think from the negative side. Actually, I want to explain him this is not negative. Buddha say not from negative side, this is positive thinking. But how can I explain him what Buddha really meant to be, and what he really want us to understand? Actually, I read a lot of your status on Facebook, and it makes me really satisfied and very peaceful every time I read. So, even though I understand, I want to share my friend, this is not from negative side, and this is from positive side. They always thought that we are changing to nuns and monks, and we are leaving our family or something like that. So how can I explain to him this is not from the negative side? Even we are in this situation, even we are with our family, we can use. Also, I want to explain him, and please guide me, Seattle. I want your advice.
Thank you. Thank you. Your question, you know, can be approached from two ways. First, philosophically, then psychologically. That is meditation. Psychologically first. If you want your friend not to feel negative, the first thing you need to do is to embrace his negativity and feel his pain. Anyone who feels negative about anything at all, about themselves, about other things, about Buddhism, about Christianity, about Islam, about non-believer, about whatever experience on earth, those people, they are not happy. You see, we have to make a choice every day. We can choose condition that will bring positive outlook and positive emotion. We can also choose, to focus on the negative condition. If someone, knowingly or unknowingly chooses the negative one, so they are letting themselves into negativity. That's what the majority of the people in the world do. If you look at the news on social media, on printed medias, on television, people actually focus so much on negativity. We all become negativity biased. So the answer is not to fight with them, not to fight with people who feeling negative, but to embrace their pain, to feel their pain, to feel as if they are only at one time, to feel for them. This is psychology. In terms of philosophy, Buddhist philosophy, you mentioned the word anatta, that is non-self, usually translated as non-self. And dukkha, usually translated as suffering. When people look at those teachings on the surface, they are bound to become pessimistic. This is quite normal. But talking about problem when there is a problem, I don't think there is anything pessimism in that. You see? This is a physician and a meditator for 50 years, more than 50 years. Professor John Kabat-Zinn from MIT. Look at the title, Full Catastrophe Living. Catastrophe is the translation of dukkha. Usually we call this suffering. He uses the word catastrophe. It's even stronger than you have suffering, you have catastrophe. Catastrophe is a very strong word. This book is saying that despite all those imperfections, shortcomings, catastrophe, to use this word, there is a way to live our life in full. This is to learn how to manage. I use the word stress here today. He uses the word catastrophe. Some translators use the word suffering. The original Pali word is dukkha. So if we are able to examine dukkha, we focus on, contemplate on dukkha, on negative things without feeling negative. You see? The Buddha, he focused so much on problems. So much on problems. The problem like involuntary problem that we have, that no one can escape. Okay, we have to feed this body, we have to clean this body, we have to dress up this body, and all these things. And we are not getting younger, and there's no guarantee that we won't get any illnesses. So those involuntary suffering, you know, they are there. Then there is another kind of suffering, there's a voluntary suffering. I mentioned earlier we have choices to be positive or negative, to top up or not to top up our stress. We have those choices. And people don't know how not to choose the negative things. I mean, some people, they don't know that. And so, not knowingly, they just choose what they think best. But that happened to be topping up the already existing stress, the already existing problem. So in neurology, like what these people are saying, if you familiarize yourself with problem, you are going to respond to the problem appropriately and not overdo it. Usually we overdo it. There is I think Bodhidharma Siyaro. This is one of the best known meditation teachers or forest meditation teacher nowadays still living. He says that only a quarter of stress is unavoidable. Three quarters are avoidable. Two quarters, when we cannot process our past experiences properly, okay, they add into the present stress. One quarter, when we relate to what might happen next, that's the future, then we add to that stress. So, if we can train the mind to live at the present moment, it's possible not to add those three quarters, the voluntary stress. So here, there is nothing wrong with a doctor talking about the symptom that the doctor, that the patient is having. Symptom means all the negative things. Symptoms are all negatives. See? This might be related to this. This might cause this, and all symptoms are all, you know, terrifying. But the doctor has no choice but to diagnose the patient in order to cure the patient. So when the Buddha talks about suffering, he doesn't end there. He actually goes on to talk about the causes of the problem, cause of suffering, and offer Okay, how to reduce this suffering? That's a way to do that, the solution. So taken as a whole, it's not possible to say that the Buddha is pessimistic or the Buddha's teaching is pessimistic. Now, in practical terms, what you have to do is to listen to your friend without being judgmental, without arguing with him, whether he's right or wrong, but just to listen to him, that he feel listened to, he feel his voice is being heard. That's the biggest reassurance you can give to him. So when he's calm, then his brain is moved to the hippocampus area, not the amygdala region anyway. At that time, he can listen to you. But you have to listen to him first.
Good evening. I'm Ravindra Jain, and I have one very interesting question which I want to know the answer of that. How much money is enough for a happy life? Like, when I was a small child, what I was thinking, today I make 5 to 10 times of more than that. So I want to know what is your answer for that, and what is the role of money for happiness? Thank you very much.
I should be the last person to answer your question. I think you should ask billionaire, not millionaires. If you read Steve Jobs' biography, okay, he's at the top of the game. Very successful. He transformed our life with this. You see? And that's what President Obama said in his eulogy. But you can't say that Steve Jobs was the happiest man. And you can also say that some people, the kind of negative emotion that they have, that their brain has developed, is because of lack of opportunities and not having enough to feed themselves, to live on. You see? So when we talk about money in Buddhism, we talk about our attitude towards money, that money is an instrument for us and for the society. And the second thing is the righteous way of earning it. And the third way is how we spend it, whether we spend it ourselves, on ourselves, or whether we spend it with families and with other people. So we focus on these three things. And happiness comes from balancing those things. One senior Buddhist monk said, okay, people invest their health to earn money. Once they have got money, they invest their money to regain their health. This is just some of the thought that people have. Instead of talking about happiness, maybe we should talk about excitement, we should talk about fulfilling. Sometimes people mistake excitement for happiness. So whether you have money or not, with or without money, happiness necessarily requires inner peace. Only if you can find some peace inside, then you're going to appreciate what you have. Happiness comes from that. Otherwise, you get new food, you go to a new restaurant, you feel very excited. But you can't go to the same restaurant many times and eat the same food. Because you get bored easily. Without inner peace, okay, the food hasn't changed, but your attitude towards that, your ability to enjoy that has changed. you no longer have the ability to enjoy it. So your happiness is taken away simply because you don't have inner peace to enjoy the good food in front of you. The same with everything else. So, people like Warren Buffett, who has so much money, maybe just after, maybe number two, three in the world, he dedicates 90% of his wealth to philanthropy. This is America Warren Buffett, who started selling newspapers, you know, when he was a self-made billionaire. Because he thinks it's more fulfilling doing that. He still earned a lot of money from hedge fund and from all those things. But that's not enough to make him, you know, feel fulfilling. So a sense of fulfilling, a sense of, well, I am 100%, you know, satisfied with my life now. How we are going to judge it? I don't know. I don't have the exact data. People say 90% of the world's wealth is concentrated in 6 people's hands. Some people say 10 or 20 people's hands, meaning in a tiny minority of people. I can't imagine them being the happiest people. Yeah. But their wealth is very important. Credit to, you know, to where the credit is due. And one of the things that I wanted to talk about, I don't have time today, is to actually train our mind to look at the full half of the glass. The full half of the glass. By doing that, we ensure that our mind is in the hippocampus area. If the mind works with that part of the brain region, is more innovative, and we don't easily give up on difficulties. I don't have the answer, but I'll give you some. microphone. I don't know who is first. Okay, maybe. Okay, you can go first.
Hi, I just have a technical question about, like, mindfulness meditation. Like, I'm a big fan of it, but I feel like I'm doing it wrong, especially when I know I'm supposed to be focusing on the breath, right? But focusing can be kind of hard when you struggle with ADHD or something like that. But I find that when I meditate and I try to focus on my breath, I think of like a million other things that turns into a million other things. So when that happens, do I focus on my train of thought? Am I supposed to be aware of that? Or like, do I get back on the breathing?
You acknowledge your thought. You have to acknowledge your thought. But to have you to do that, I'd like to suggest, before you meditate, first tell yourself that you will have a lot of thought, that you will entertain them, you will welcome them. Okay. If you develop dislike towards your thought, that's the worst way to deal with them. Just your thought is one thing. Dislike towards them is another. Okay. So expect them. This is expectation management. The second thing is that when you can't really focus, you can do some movement. In meditation, sometimes you can say breathing in, breathing out. If it comes to that point, you can do that. It's okay. Even walking meditation, you know, not moving with your hand, but moving with your feet. You're moving all the time. Yeah. So this is possible. One thing that you perhaps is helpful to remember is not to fight with those thoughts. And of course, we easily get carried away by the contents. We're interested in the contents. But this is illusion. We think by solving some of the content, we will solve it. Actually, we have to solve the very behavior of our mind, the emotional behavior, the emotional pattern that we have. So, automatic thinking is a pattern, so recognize that. And that this is automatic thinking, this is automatic thinking pattern.
Sayadaw, thank you very much for your presence and your talk. You said something that intrigued me at the beginning of your talk. You mentioned that in Madrid University they were studying meditation and the heart. And my question, I don't know if it's a strange one, is if you can say a little bit more about mindfulness and heartfulness, and indeed, is there a difference, or if so, what is the difference?
I can say about heartfulness, not in the sense of physiological understanding, but in terms of emotion management. I talk about compassion and joy, two qualities that we need for heartfulness. This is kindness, another word for kindness. Compassion is to embrace pain. Joy is to actually notice the sunshine part, okay, in our life, in our surrounding. So this is to keep our emotion balanced. This will help us to not feel frightened when we see people doing well and successful. Not to feel jealous. And instead, part of being heartfulness, part of being heartful is that when we see people successful, if we can feel the same joy as they do. And of course, the same with feeling their pain, if we can empathize with them. I would consider this to be heartfulness. Sometimes heartfulness is only focusing on the difficulty, the negative side. When people are in pain, you empathize with them at that. But when they are doing well, you know, you are sort of disconnect with them. So that compassion is so vulnerable. Vulnerable because, you know, you see no reason to be compassionate towards anyone who is doing well. Now, going back to Madrid University research, they only tell me a certain thing because they haven't finished this project, they haven't published this, and I'm not a party to this research, so I'm not supposed to know a lot. But the gist is that heart is the, you can study many indications of stress, of the, maybe similar things like what we find in the brain, in the heart. This is maybe a new finding that we are expecting.
Thank you for Dharma talk. I would like to ask, in your university in Shen State, is there any BA program for the foreign valet or not?
At the moment, we haven't got a BA program. We started with master's and PhD because I think the undergrad programs are offered in many places. And what we need here is supervision skill, research skill, that sort of thing. So we focus our resources on this. At some point in the future, we hope to extend it. But so far, we concentrate on the postgraduate level. I would like to focus on, well, I'd like to introduce the type of maybe I shouldn't say English. I would like to combine the two resources that I know. One is the earlier rigorous monastic study that we have here, which is available only in some part of our program in this country. The other is what I have learned in Oxford, and two of my assistants, one from who has a PhD in Pali from Cambridge, the other from King's College London. So we would like to introduce the kind of study skill that we have learned from there. So by combining these two, we have introduced a 2 year master program where you can say, it's student-focused, student-centered. And as Sim mentioned earlier, we have enough resources for the study that we have introduced. Resources are mainly in the English medium, not 20,000, but 16,000. Yeah, 16,000. Titles in Buddhist studies. Okay. Hi. Okay.
Thank you for your talk.
Thank you.
My question is for the first part of meditation when you're acknowledging something, so you've got a sensation going through your body. Is it important to name what that is, whether it's anxiety or anger, or is it as effective just to feel it and to breathe?
It's very helpful to name at the beginning. It's very helpful because you know what is it. We use a lot of words in daily life. So by naming it, we are connecting it with our daily experiences. But even if you name it, at some point you have to drop this naming technique. In Myanmar, Ming Kun tradition, Mahasi tradition, they use this naming technique. But at some point, when the teacher thinks, okay, you can go without these naming activities, they ask you to drop it and just be present with those emotions. But usually people can't do that. They get carried away. So you name it 2, 3, 4 times and you leave it.
Thank you.
Here, in the first row.
Thank you very much, Sarah, for your Dhamma talk. I would like to ask about the Sila, observing Sila. It is, I think, very helpful for the life in terms of emotional management if we can keep the Sila. But I see some people struggling with kind of anxiety keeping Sila, and I would like to have a listen to your opinion.
Sila, there's this moral practice, ethical practices. They are very important, not just for religious people like you and me, but for business people. It's important they do business ethically. For family members that they live together, ethically, that they trust each other, please have a seat. So Sila, in that aspect, is for the whole society to live together in harmony. Now, we talk about Sila for individuals. Now, we should also talk about Sila for groups. We should also talk about Sila for institution. You see, this is an important part because I say this because some people don't believe in collective karma. I believe in this. But we have to look at the role of sila in the context of the Eightfold Path. When someone has anxiety, meaning to keep or not to keep sila, this one, the issue goes beyond sila. It's about the mind, it's about samadhi and panya. You see? So sila in the Buddhist practice is always understood in the context of samadhi and panya. Sila is purified and perfected in the context of samadhi and panya. Those three, they can't be separated. The reason that we have the Buddhist will with one will, eight spoke, is that the message is those eight qualities, they integrate and function at the same time. They do one function. That is to remove the sources of unhappiness. And sila is one of the three. Samadhi, concentration, meditation is another. Changing our attitude and understanding, transforming it, or transform our emotion, panya, that's another one. Those three. So I always look at them in that context, not sila alone, not meditation alone. Like in the West, sometimes, those days especially, in the early days, people tend to look at meditation separately from sila. And in some Buddhist communities, some Buddhists tend to look at sila separately from meditation. They say they are not yet ready for meditation. They just go for sila, that sort of thing. I don't think if we separate those things, that would make the Eightfold Path or the Middle Path. We have to try to integrate them.
So may I take the last question, Theodore? Being a Singaporean, living in a multi-culture, multi-religion society, so we are very comfortable living with different religious believers, and I hope the same is happening in Myanmar. But I do face a serious problem recently. In fact, Buddhism, in my view, is that it's the most inclusive religion. But Myanmar seems to be Buddhism or Buddhist becomes more and more exclusive in a sense that especially towards Muslim. My office, I have got Christians and we have got two Muslims. But these two Muslims are actually working with us for more than 10 years, so they are well accepted among the staff. Some of my staffs are here, so it's something that I do not know how to manage. That I have difficulty, and I understand for many of my friends, they have big difficulty to engage Muslims into their company. Somehow, they are very much rejected. And this is a very dangerous trend for a country by and large. I remember there's a book, The Enemy Within. And we are certainly facing this problem, but can we overcome it and how shall we handle this?
I usually focus on positive things. This doesn't mean that I actually ignore problems, but I would like to believe I don't have the data. I'm not sure if you have it either. I have the data. You have more tolerant people than those who don't tolerate. You have more people who like to live their life in peace than a tiny minority, you know, who feel agitated seeing anything different. You would have the same intolerance in every community. This is not unique to Buddhism, to Buddhists in Myanmar. Okay. If you care to look at carefully different communities, you will have people who live in fear because that's the way they have been brought up. And they haven't got enough exposure. So, my My belief is that we have to promote the positive value that we believe in. A few months ago, I was invited by, I was part of those invited by the German Federal Foreign Ministry for Peace conference. Before we started the conference, a delegate from India started asking about our situation back here. Would the people who fled would be able to come back? As a question. This was not the question, it was the clarification of his question. But his question was, what happened to the Rakhine region? He used the word Rohingya, which we don't use here. I said, okay, what do you mean? He said, okay, would they be able to come back? And I asked him, are you aware of Kofi Annan's commission? No, he said he wasn't aware of it. Are you aware of the International Advisory Committee that came out of that? No, he wasn't aware. Are you aware that, you know, the Bangladeshi and Myanmar interior ministers and foreign ministers, they meet every now and then, almost every other month in each other's capital? No, he's not aware. I said, okay, when you ask this question like this, if you only based on what you know from the international media, we from Myanmar would think that your question is not balanced and is I feel compelled that I focus, I tell you more positive things taking place, positive effort being put into in order to address the problem. So we stop at that. So what I'm trying to say is that, okay, people are not the media is not interested in promoting how people live in harmony in many parts of the country, but they would focus on the hotspot and would try to say that is the image of Myanmar. So one of the things that I had said publicly in conferences and also in interfaith meeting is that in Myanmar, what we need to do is we need to do engaged tolerance. At the moment, we have disengaged tolerance. We have tolerance with each other, but we don't engage with each other. This is not the fault of anyone. We just haven't had the opportunity to do this. So I call it disengaged tolerance. People are tolerant of each other, but they don't engage, they don't interact with each other. Okay? This is a problem within one community and also between communities. Okay? This is a big problem. A big problem. So, if you start in encouraging engagement with the political situation has allowed, then the community leaders, the establishment, the everything. If there is leadership in this engaged tolerance, I think the problem that we have, where we have it, and when we have it, it can be solved.
Thank you very much. Okay, thank you very much, everybody, for November 22 was Sayadaw's birthday. So my wife wants to present a present to him. Lovely. On behalf of our company, I want to present. I know that Sayadaw reads a lot. This is
reading them. Yeah, well, thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
So I also like to thank everyone. So thank you for this.